I can have your attention, please. We're going to start our proceedings this afternoon. I'd like to thank all of you for braving the cold and coming to this room to hear our panel talk about the questions posed by the special master's recommendations in the campaign for fiscal equity decision. The CFE story is actually a classic example of how governmental decisions of the most profound consequences that affect the city are not made in the city, but made instead at the state level, in this case at the courts, but ultimately will be made by the decision makers in Albany. Recognizing the vital importance of such questions and the importance of state policy generally, the Manhattan Institute has announced a new project which we officially launched last week, which is the Empire Center for New York State Public Policy, chaired and directed by E.J. McMahon, who is our senior fellow for budget and taxation issues. And obviously a man much beloved by the audience. The center will work on looking at the wide range of issues facing New York State, both as they implicate the city and as they implicate the state as a whole, not simply fiscal issues, but also issues such as education, healthcare, and the other important issues that face us as New York citizens. It'll be based in Albany, and we have a press release which will give you a little more detail about the Empire Center and its work, which is available as you leave. Today's panel contains a wide range of viewpoints as to what ought to be done as in reaction to the special master's decision and what the best way to govern New York City's school system for the benefit of the children actually are. I will leave the introduction of the individual panelists to our moderator, Toni Coles. Randy Weingarten is, we've contacted her. She is on her way and stuck in traffic. She will be here momentarily. So let me turn it over to Toni, who is deputy mayor in Rudy Giuliani's administration and is currently an attorney at Patterson Belknap. Toni.
Hi. I guess my job is to create a little context for the discussion today and also to introduce the panel. And then, as Henry said, if they go over their allotted time, I'm supposed to start squirming uncontrollably in my seat. So I'll do that. The New York State Constitution does have what they call an education article. And that's really where the context for this discussion starts. What the education article of the Constitution says, and it's pretty simple, is the legislature shall provide for the maintenance and support of a system of free common schools wherein all the children of the state may be educated. Now, that doesn't address at all how they should be educated or how well they should be educated. It just says you need to have a free public school system. But over the years, the courts have read into that an additional meaning. Randy, come on up. We were just starting. The courts have read into that education article an additional standard, which is basically that the education provided must be a sound basic education. In 1993 or so, a group of education advocates, parents, and others brought a lawsuit saying that the students in the New York City public school system were not receiving a sound basic education, and the reason for that was that they were being shortchanged financially by New York State. About 10 years later, in 2003, they ultimately won their case before the New York Court of Appeals, which is the state's highest court. And basically what the Court of Appeals said is that the state is underfunding the New York City school system, that that has to be rectified, and they set up sort of a schematic approach. They basically made their determination by looking at three inputs into the school system. They looked at teaching, facilities, and supplies, and two outputs, which are graduation rates and test scores. And they essentially said, by additional money, you can improve teaching, you can get better facilities, and you can get better supplies, and that will lead to better outputs, to better graduation rates, and to higher test scores. However, and this is significant, the court did not fix the amount of money that was necessary in order to bring New York City school kids up to the level of a sound basic education, or what they defined as a sound basic education. Instead, the court sort of bounced that question, as they should have, to the governor and to the state legislature. Needless to say, the governor and the state legislature couldn't figure out what the right amount of money was either, and the question got bounced back to the original trial judge in the case, a Judge Leland DeGrasse. Judge DeGrasse decided he wasn't going to decide that question because it's a difficult question directly, and he set up a panel of two retired judges and a former law school dean to make a recommendation to him as to what amount of money was necessary to fix the New York school system. Well, the panel didn't have any trouble. They basically said to fix the New York City school system, you need additional operating money of $5.63 billion a year on top of the about $14 billion that the school system now gets, and you need about $1.8 million in facilities money, additional facilities money, a year for at least 4 years. So essentially, what the panel went on to say was that $5.63 billion in operating funds couldn't possibly be absorbed by the city school system in 1 year, and so they would phase the $5.63 billion in over 4 years, and the $1.8 in capital would be given to the city over, or should be given to the city over 4 years. So essentially, what they said is a combination of operating and capital expenses amounting to about $23 billion over the next 4 years should be enough to fix the school system. That recommendation has now gone back to Judge DeGrasse. Now, maybe that's the silver bullet, and maybe the $5.63 billion a year and the additional approximately two in operating money is enough to fix the school system. Maybe it's not. There are some people who say that that is just good money after bad. There are others who say this is a eureka moment in the school system, and we finally got an opportunity to turn things around. And that's what our panel is going to address today. We have a terrific panel. We have Saul Stern, who's a contributing editor to City Journal and a Manhattan Institute senior fellow. We have Chuck Brescher, who's a professor of public health and administration and also is the director, the research director for the Citizens Budget Commission, which is a nonpartisan civic organization. We have Randy Weingarten. Randy is president of the United Federation of Teachers, representing more than 140,000 active and retired educators in New York. And she's also vice president of the New York City Central Labor Council and also heads the City Municipal Labor Committee. And we also have Jay Green, who is a senior fellow with the Manhattan Institute and has written a great deal on education issues. So it is a terrific panel. I'd like to start with Saul, and he'll address some of the questions that I'm sure we're all thinking about today. Thank you.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Thank you, Tony. And it's terrific that we have this panel. Tony described this 10-year odyssey of this case going through the courts with tremendous implications for all of us, for the kids, for the school system, and not least of all for the New York City and New York State economy. And it's kind of sad that all of this went on for 10 years with very little public debate about it. There was a kind of consensus that this is a wonderful process, justice is being addressed, and as I said, very little debate. I did a piece about this, some of the issues in City Journal about a year ago, and in the 8 minutes, probably by now it's 7 minutes that have been allotted, I would just like to lay down some markers and kind of indicate some of the things that I think is not sufficiently appreciated about the case out there in the public, and my co-panelists, I'm sure, will disagree about some of these markers. But first of all, Randy will actually agree about a lot. The first thing, Tony alluded to this. In my view, what this is essentially about is an attempt by special interest groups to take more money from the private sector, push it over to the public sector with, they claim, very, very good intentions to get our kids a better education. So it's at its heart, this is about money. We all understand this. But no one, I think there's not sufficient understanding out there in the public, including the way it's been covered in the media, about how much money. Tony mentioned the final numbers at the court. But we have to also look at how much the city is spending on education now. If you look at the city official numbers, we right today for fiscal 2005, the city is spending close to $15 billion on its education system. More important is that this is a huge increase in the amount that we've been spending since the litigation started, but more importantly, over the last 7 or 8 years. From 1997 to 2005 alone, the budget, city budget, went up from about $8 billion to the current $15 billion. My calculation is, we could argue about the precisely the numbers, that this now works out to about $13,000 per pupil. In my view, that's a lot of money, and I'll indicate a little why I think that's a lot of money. So it's not a question of, as it's been framed often in the media, of a poor school district having some recourse to equity. In my view, a rich school district getting very much richer. Because what happens if in fact the $5.63 billion comes to the city, and I'm talking about operating expenses now, the capital budget is a separate, in my view, is a separate issue. I actually think that there's more of an argument for more money there, because at least you know what you're getting. You know, you build a building, it's a building, kids can use it. But if the city gets the $5.63 billion, the city budget for education will be over $20 billion a year, or close to about $18,000 per pupil. Now think of that, the $13,000 now and the $18,000 eventually. And try, you know, let's compare that. Let's throw out some other figures. Compare that. What does it mean? What does it mean in some context? Finland is probably scores higher than any other industrialized country on international tests. They came in first in the last OECD comparison of students in reading literacy, and came in fourth in math literacy. Finland, as of 2000, probably has gone up a little, but as of 2000, Finland was spending $5,000 per pupil. Moreover, class size in Finland average more than 30, and kids in Finland don't even start school until they're 7 years old. I'll throw out another number, closer to home. A lot of people may think it's all irrelevant, it's European numbers, they may spend some of the money, may be spent by the government in other areas. Fine, let's look at the Catholic schools in New York City. It's another school system. $18,000, if we eventually get that money, $18,000 would basically send about 5 kids to a New York City elementary Catholic school, an elementary school. It'll send about 3 kids to a Catholic high school, very good Catholic high schools. And the likelihood is those kids will have a higher chance of graduating from school. So I know people out there will say, well, who cares about Finland and who cares about the Catholic schools? This is a question of equity. You know, why we compare it to those two systems? Let's compare what we spend to the suburbs. That's more important. The suburbs spend more than we do, and it's a question of equity. And there is a very strong argument for that. And as a philosophical principle, I would support the idea that a kid in Scarsdale should get no more than a kid in New York City. My kids who went through the New York City public schools deserve as much money, in my view, philosophically, as a kid in Scarsdale. So clearly, a lot of New York suburban districts spend more than New York City. Scarsdale spends now about $18,000. But there's also a wide variety. If you're talking about equity, there's equity issues within the suburban schools. For example, I was just looking through some of the state numbers. Go out to Nassau. Elmont actually spends far less than we do. The Elmont School District, figures as of 2003, spends $9,000 per pupil. Mamaroneck spends close to $20,000 per pupil. You want to go further out on the island, Fire Island spends $32,000 per pupil, and Bridgehampton spends $45,000 per pupil. I don't think anybody here would take their kids out of a private school and send them to the Bridgehampton schools, even though they're spending twice as much as even, let's say, Trinity or Horace Mann. But in any event, all of this is irrelevant. The question of what the suburbs spend is irrelevant to our discussion, because this is not a lawsuit about equity. Another great general misunderstanding out there in the public. Because the precedents, the legal precedents, are here, were clearly established that you cannot make a case that New York City kids should get more money because Scarsdale kids get a lot more money. No one has been able to make that case in the courts that the state constitution guarantees every kid in the state an equal amount of spending. Now, you may think that's unfortunate philosophically, you may argue, but that happens to be the legal precedent. So the case had to be filed on the basis of adequacy, as Tony mentioned. In other words, the argument was, if the Constitution requires every kid to get a sound basic education, and New York City is not providing a sound basic education, then the state has a responsibility to provide the resources to provide that sound basic education. That's what the case was fought on. Unfortunately, in my view, there's a tremendous amount of misunderstanding continued because the plaintiffs who brought the case continued to call themselves the Campaign for Fiscal Equity, even though it was not a fiscal equity case. And then you can see why. It's much more attractive to make the argument that we're fighting for fiscal equity. Michael Rebell, who won the case, who's the chair of CFE and is the lead lawyer, is a very good lawyer. He's even very much better at public relations. And this was an enormous public relations victory from the start, before the case even began. And I would argue what an effect you had here in that trial before Judge DeGrasse was a kangaroo court. There was no chance that the state could win because it was framed, even though in the courtroom it had to be, it was adequacy, it was framed as a question of civil rights. Now, who's going to argue against civil rights for New York City kids? So the entire media, I mean, Bob Herbert of the Times, once even wrote a column denouncing the lawyers for the state, some private lawyers that were hired to defend the case, as a bunch of Southern segregationists. What were they doing? They came up north to try to deny New York City kids an equal education, even though that was not what the case was about. So I think it was inevitable that the judge was going to make that case. In my view, the state probably should have gone in and conceded the point about the lack of a sound basic education. It should have stipulated and said, Your Honor, we agree. The kids in New York City are getting a terrible education. Now let's talk about the remedies. What are the remedies? Should we do vouchers, maybe? Well, should we have better pedagogy to teach kids how to read? Should we pay our teachers based on performance and productivity rather than on the fact of the number of years they've been in the system? All these possibilities for improving the system and actually delivering the sound basic education, that was gone from, unfortunately, the judge, who, by the way, was appointed by the, you know, an Otis job to the Manhattan County Democratic boss, and in a case that was favored by the entire political and educational establishment in New York, it was a foregone conclusion. But let me say something about the evidence in the trial. And this may sound a little shocking, but I would say very carefully. There was not, in my view, looking at most of the transcript, there was not a single piece of credible evidence introduced linking a specific amount of spending or increase in spending to any improvement in student outcomes. None. Which is partly explains why the judge, he couldn't figure out how much money it would take to deliver a sound basic education. The Court of Appeals couldn't figure it out. And they decided to, as Tony put it very well, they punted the issue to the state legislature. The state legislature also couldn't figure it out. Now, we tend to think of our state legislature as somewhat dysfunctional and incompetent. But in this case, I kind of feel sorry for them and for the governor because they were dealing with an absurdity. The notion that any group of scholars, experts, politicians, anyone could sit down and say, okay, we don't have a sound basic education, we're not delivering in New York City, here's the amount that will do it. Because it leaves out everything that's important about education, about the quality of teaching, about the productivity, about the morale of the teaching, about the kids' background, all these other things. Money doesn't solve that issue. It can't solve the issue. So, of course, they couldn't come up with a number. So how did we get the number 5.6? Tony mentioned that it came out this was what the three masters decided on. Actually, this number is actually the plaintiff's number. Now, they did hire some consultants, two organizations, one called AIR, American Institute for Research, and MAP, Management Analysis Planning. And they did what's called in the business, and there's a business now because these cases are occurring all over the country. And so there are these consulting companies that will come in and do what's called a costing out study. What is the costing out study? Is it some magical scientific approach to actually find that number? No, not at all. Matter of fact, all you have to do is go to the report that they issued, read the preface, and they will acknowledge. It's set in black and white in the preface. This is not science. And we could come up with different numbers based on the inputs that we put in. What are the inputs? At the core of their methodology is what's called a professional judgment panel. They gather a group of teachers, administrators from the education system, who, after all, are supposed to know something. They sit them down in a room and they give them certain parameters. They have a computer nearby. You're squirming, huh? Okay. And they tell, and these teachers and administrators decide based on the system, these parameters. What are the inputs? What do we need to provide a sound basic education? And then the consultants then quantify that, cost that out. So the teachers and administrators decide how many teachers per pupil do we need, issues like that, how many guidance counselors. Well, who is it that was sitting on this professional judgment panel? These philosopher kings, so to speak, who can sit there objectively and make a decision. And the two professional judgment panels that made the basic core decision about how much money, not the money, but the inputs that New York City would need to provide a sound basic education, every single person on those two judgment panels were employees of the New York City Department of Education. Conflict of interest, God forbid. I don't know. Special interest, God forbid. And here is the really funny part about that. This is the really absurd aspect of this. The defense in the trial had the same idea. Let's get a couple of consultants and get them to say how much money the city, you know, how much money would be required, or if there more money was required. So the state, during the trial, hired one of these consultants, AIR, using a professional judgment panel composed of non-city employees. They delivered a report to the court which said, we don't think that you need a lot more money. We think you can probably do it for the $11, $12 billion you have at the time. Guess what? The defense, the plaintiffs, who you then hired AIR after the verdict came in, during the trial said, we reject it. We made a motion to the judge saying it should be thrown out. It's all hearsay. It's not probative. And the judge threw it out. So it was not admitted into evidence. Now that Tony's squirming even more, I'm going to have to cut it off. Basically, we got ourselves a raw deal. We're going to spend a lot of money without any guarantee that student outcomes will be improved. The taxes are going to kill the city and kill the state. It's a sad day, I think. There's nothing good in this. And the saddest part about it is there's so many people who should have known better all these years, including fiscal conservatives like the mayor, and elements in the business community stood by and are still standing by and somehow trying to find the silver lining in all this. I don't see anything of that. Thank you. And I'm sorry.
Well, the Citizens Budget Commission has gotten involved in this issue, and we have been for about a year, because, as Saul said, it's very much about money. We don't claim to be experts so much in how to do the process of education, but we do have a very real concern with money and how we use money wisely. And Saul's right to say this is a case about money, but maybe only half right, in the sense that our take on this is that it's not just about money. It's about how you use that money. And that the court case should be used as an opportunity to say, it may be that we have to spend some more money to deliver a sound basic education, but kids are not going to get a sound basic education if we don't make some changes in the way in which we do the business of education. And those two things have to go together. So this case should be about how much we spend, but also how we spend it. And we have done some research that really addresses both dimensions of that. We held a conference and put out a report last December, early in December. This booklet, which is available on our website, you know, Can New York Get an A in School Finance Reform? We're not the only state that's been going through this process, as Saul mentioned. There are court cases in other places. We're trying to learn from what they do and some of the mistakes that they've made. There's a way to do this right. And doing it right may mean spending some more money. It seems inevitable. It's what the courts have said. I'm not going to argue the law. But we ought to spend the money differently. And what I want to focus on is the issues of how we ought to do things differently as we put more money into the system. And in particular, divide that up between the operating budget, which is the $5.6 billion that has been talked about, and the capital money. We have made suggestions about how to spend the operating money better. They include some things that I think are going to be discussed by Jay, including incorporating some performance pay into the system, changing some of the rules about how we deploy teachers. I'm glad to come back to that. I want to wait and give him a chance to put forth his views on those issues. So I thought I'd take my, what's now maybe 7 minutes left, and focus more on the capital budget issues, because that also is big money. Part of what the Campaign for Fiscal Equity did, and I think it's a contribution in this case, is to actually say, what is the problem with the physical plant of the city of New York? What do we have to do to improve the school system in order to provide the conditions for a sound basic education? They did a study that they presented to the court that tried to assess the conditions of the schools, both the physical plant, the degree of crowding. They identified $14.7 billion in needs, this was in 2003 dollars, that need to be made. Of that, about $12 billion was new construction, that is expanding the plant, and that's the part I want to talk to. They said, and I think these are reasonably accurate numbers, so it's where I'm going to stop agreeing with them, but that there is currently overcrowding that involves about 68,000 students. Too many kids in a classroom or inappropriate classroom space. But the other part of it was that the operating increase is so great is that they have defined the conditions of a sound basic education as involving smaller class sizes. And if you're going to have smaller class sizes, you need more classrooms. So there is an additional $2.8 billion that goes to creating the classrooms to accommodate the smaller class sizes in sort of step one of this, which is getting to minimums of 20 in the lower grades and 23 or 24 in the upper grades. Because the longer the conditions that were established in these costing out studies that's all referred to was actually to get to class sizes of 16 or so, there's another $6 billion in creating the classroom capacity that you need to get down to those lower classroom sizes. Plus, they've said that we also need to be providing pre-kindergarten experience for more children now. It's not mandatory. Many of them don't get it. And again, we need the space for that. So to build that space, that's how you get to build the space to accommodate the current overcrowding, the needs for reduced classroom size, and the need to expand pre-kindergarten opportunities for kids accounts for about $12 billion of the $14 billion in needs. And what I'm here to say is that we don't need to spend that $12 billion. We can do it better and quicker by using two different strategies that so far the court has not been willing to mandate and the city has not voluntarily taken up. But we can, as I said, we can save this money and get the kids the sound basic education quicker by doing two things. One is rezoning. There's a lot of talk about overcrowding in the school system. The fact is the system is a mix of schools that have, some schools have too many students and some have too few. if you add up the pluses and minuses across the system, there actually are schools that the schools that have empty seats outnumber the schools that have overcrowding by about 136,000. So if you could do perfect matching, and it may not be possible to get perfect matching, but if you could do perfect matching, you create 136,000 seats. That's about half the new need in this. It means that, again, we have to change the way we do business. Zoning has been the province of the school boards. They have not wanted to send kids out of their local districts in the past. There hasn't been a lot of cross, and there hasn't even been a lot of changing of zones for some of the schools within the districts. It has lots of political dimensions about this. Parents are affected. There are different kinds of racial and ethnic integration that takes place if you do this. But the fact is we can save about $500 million if we just use the plant with zoning. And it's not a matter of that the empty school is in Staten Island and the crowded one is in the Bronx and kids would have to travel 2 hours. We did a piece of analysis, and I put out some of the book list that's the backup for this on the tables, but looking at it by within regions, and most of the net balance also occurs within regions. So we're not talking about tremendous travel times. It really is just rethinking how we send kids to school. So rezoning is one key piece of this. The second piece is what I will refer to as year-round education. And there are lots of varieties of year-round education. Some people use the term to refer to sending kids to school more days per year. We now have about 180 days mandated. You can talk about upping that as to how many days kids go to school. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm saying if we provide kids with the same 180 days, but use the schools more intensely all year, we still live with an astounding amount of lack of questioning with a school system that's predicated on the idea that the kids have to be home in the summer to help harvest the crops. And it's not. There may be a farm left in Queens, but it is not really what we have to do here in New York. And we haven't changed that. But if we did, if we use the schools on an equal basis year-round, in fact, you can go to a system where you increase, because they are now vacant weekdays about a third of the number of years, 180 out of 240, when we could be using the schools. So if you use the schools year-round, all right, you increase school capacity, the same building we've got now, by a third. This is not like my bright idea today, this morning. This is done in school systems all around the country. There are 2 million kids in the United States who go to school year-round. They've been doing it in Los Angeles and other big city systems for a long time. Crowded systems have discovered this a long time ago. We've had some very tentative exploration of it in some of the schools in New York City. We don't do it on any reasonable scale. Now, you won't get the full one-third increase in capacity because you do want to have some kids going to what we now call summer school, but using it for remediation, extending the school year for some kids. If you take if you reserve some capacity for that, you don't get the full one-third. A third on a million kids is 300-some-odd thousand. We're saying do it, reserve the capacity you now have for summer school. All right. And you also don't want to use some of the temporary buildings we have now on a year-round basis. You want to shut them down. You want to use the good plant for year-round schooling. If you do that, you get about another 135,000 seats at a year-round schooling. The combination of rezoning and year-round schooling meets all of the need identified for extra classroom capacity by the Campaign for Fiscal Equity, and you do it without having to build one more new classroom. So you get there, and you get there quicker. The interesting thing about the Campaign for Fiscal Equity is $14-some-odd billion. They didn't have the nerve to ask the judge for all $14 billion. They only actually asked for $9 billion. And they said, we'll wait at least 5 years to even start on some of the pre-kindergarten expansion. So they, by their own standards, they're not going to provide people with a sound basic education for at least 10 years, even if they get the $9 billion in capital. We'll still be waiting 10 years to create those pre-K spaces. So changing the way we do business with year-round education, we get there quicker, and on top of that, there's a considerable amount of evidence that it's actually better, that if you reschedule kids so that they're not out of school for 10 weeks in the summer, you don't have to spend the first 5 weeks of the semester going over what you learned in third grade when you start fourth and so on. And in fact, there are some educational benefits to this as well. So again, if we just think a little bit imaginatively, and again, we're not inventing anything new, it's happening all over the country, we can save about $12 billion on the capital side by doing things more sensibly. And that's one of the ideas that we at CBC feel ought to be incorporated. This is a moment to use the court case to say, hey, let's rethink this. And if we're going to put up more money for the other parts of the capital and the operating budget, let's say going to year-round schooling ought to be part of this. The panel of judges, the CBC filed an amicus brief with the court on this when they were trying to come up with a solution. And the footnote in the referees panel dealing with this said that they didn't want to mess with the school calendar, but they recognized that this was a way that you could do things differently. The school calendar is now a matter of state law, I'll stop it, because you can only get state aid if you hold school during the regular year. They don't pay state aid for summer school. So you have to get the state legislature to go along with this, but it can be done. It's done in a lot of other places, and we ought to get more bang for the buck by doing these things.
First off, I'm pleased to be here. And let me just say that I actually agree with Sal and Chuck on the proposition that you can't write a check, give the city unlimited spending authority, and say, that's fine. You have to spend this money, if we ever get this money, on the right things, or we will never see, because we're never going to see another opportunity like this. So the issue of not just money mattering, which I may disagree with Sal on, I do think money matters, I'll talk about that in a little while, but the issue of how you spend it and the accountability, to me, is as important as getting it. And that is one of the reasons why, I'm sure it will surprise some of you, that I actually sat on the ZARP Commission. I actually announced the ZARP Commission report with the governor and the chairman of that commission. The ZARP Commission was the governor's commission about how to spend the money. The Masters actually saw, even though the number was close to what the plaintiffs proposed, the Masters actually used the successful school model that the ZARP Commission at Standards and Poor had articulated as the way to get to a result. What was striking about listening to the testimony that the Masters heard was how much consensus there was between the plaintiff's position at that point of how much money was needed and the defendant's position. The range was about $4.3 billion to $5.6 billion. And you're right, they took the higher end of that range, not the lower end. But it was actually based upon the ZARP Commission processes. And Chuck, we actually have agreed with the pilot project that, I know pilot is a bad word these days, but we agreed with the pilot project that Terry Thompson had tried to get through the legislature, seeing if we could have like five year-round schools and et cetera, et cetera. But you should know that LA, as well as some of the other districts that have used year-round schooling, are disbanding it because for lots of different reasons, which I won't go into, it hasn't worked in those communities. We do use it in special education for some of the same reasons that you just said. There's something called the 683 program for kids with significant disabilities, and it's one of the reasons why special ed is so expensive. Let me talk briefly. I probably have about four more minutes or five more minutes. Look, I've never gotten arrested before this case, and I was so frustrated with the fact that the legislature didn't and the governor didn't do what they needed to do so that it wouldn't be in the court's hands anymore, it would be in the people's hands. I, as well as many others, blocked the doors of the state legislature in June, about 23 of us, to say you haven't done your job because it's back in the courts because the legislature didn't do their job. And frankly, I would argue that the court was pretty smart to say we can't figure this out. The legislature should really figure this out in terms of both the balance of how much New York City should spend, how much the state should spend, and also what it should be spent on. There are five issues that I think this money should be spent on are five basic issues that are essential to a sound basic education. They're valuable, obviously, for all children, but even more critical if we want, as I think we all do, to level the playing field between children of poverty and children who are more advantaged. Because the underlying issue here that Justice DeGrasse said was that demography should not be destiny. That's the underlying issue. And as someone who went to schools in the suburbs of New York City and saw what we got, I got, my sister got, and I see what happens in schools, I've been involved in the teachers' union for 20 years, it is pretty, you can understand the anger that I feel in the choices that have been made against children of color in this city, particularly. So what are the five issues? Qualified teacher in every classroom is number one. Class sizes that are small enough so that a well-prepared teacher can attend to each child's individualized needs, number two. And number three, an enriched early childhood education to ensure that every child has the foundational skills on which learning is built. And anybody who ever listened to Reed Lyon, who happens to be George W. Bush's chief education advisor, and somebody who I believe in a lot, you would become a convert to the needs of early childhood education because of where the research is about how kids learn. But in addition to those three issues, the two other issues that I think funding should go to is obviously a safe and orderly environment with appropriate facilities. You can't teach Regents science if a school doesn't have an appropriate lab. And five is when kids are falling behind, and more we have to focus on the dropout rate, that in a global economy, having a high school dropout rate hovering around 50% is absolutely, not just, I mean, it's a tragedy. So you have to have a platform of learning opportunities for kids who are falling behind. Now, ultimately, what you really want me to talk about is the first one in terms of qualified teachers, because that's the one about pay for performance, competitive pay, and all these other things. And let me just say, number one, I have spent a lot of time thinking about these issues. I've shared the AFT report that talked about compensation, that said we should look at the kind of differentials that some of you talk about in this room when I'm not here, but said that we need to have competitive pay first. And in fact, if you look at the Gerstner report, you look at the Zarb report, they all come to that essential agreement, which is that if we don't do something about competitive pay before we start talking about incentives and differentials, then what we're going to do is we will not have qualified teachers for every single school child. Because it's not just about recruitment. Most importantly these days, it's about retention. And we have to focus on the fact that in schooling, not just in New York City, but in so many other urban systems, by the fifth year of a teacher's career, fifth or sixth year, look at it, you got a turnover of almost 50% in the city of New York. By the fifth or sixth year, almost 50%. And there are new studies that show, yes, it's about mentoring, it's about safety, it's about lack of respect, it's about lack of support, but it's about salary. And I love it. And look, I may be in the charter business as early as next month if my delegate assembly approves the United Federation of Teachers actually submitting an application to have two charter schools. But for somebody who was schooled in economics, labor economics in particular, anytime I hear people talk about competition, and they don't look at both the macro and micro issues about labor market competition, I just say that's a real double standard. At the same time, what a lot of you want me to do, and what I have done, is said this. If we could figure out what a competitive salary is, I would actually argue to you that in New York City, because the learning conditions are tougher, the teaching conditions are tougher, on and on and on, salaries should be higher in New York City for teachers than they are in the suburbs. But many of you will say, if you really believe that, Randy, then shouldn't there be differentials for hard-to-staff schools? Isn't that what Ray DeMonaco says? Isn't that what I've heard other people say? And I agree with you. There should be. And in fact, in May, we propose a school enterprise zone that says that for the 200, take some of this money, for the 200 hardest-to-staff schools, let's make them the gold standard. But let's figure out how we get everybody in that school a 15% pay differential from the principal to the secretary to the janitor. Let's make those schools the gold standard, and let's also focus on a couple of other things. We got to focus on nutrition. We got to focus on health. I would argue we also have to focus on housing. And let's make that the gold standard. I raised that publicly. I raised that in collective bargaining. Hasn't been responded to yet. Now, there's lots of other kinds of differentials and incentives that we could deal with, we could suggest, we could propose. I've proposed a bunch of them. But it's a myth to say that we're not into that. But we are into trying to figure out how you have a competitive base for teachers first and foremost, because we don't have a captive female labor market anymore. We need to attract and retain the best and the brightest, and we need people who are really smart as teachers if we are really going to do what everybody says we should, which is to help kids get to the higher standards required in the global economy. That becomes something where if we could negotiate these things, I believe you would see real reform and real tremendous capacity making in the city school system. I'll stop there because I'm sure that I've used my time.
Well, I think we actually have a fair amount of agreement on some things. I think the basic agreement is that there's probably going to be more money coming to the New York City schools. And I think we also agree on this panel that it matters very much how you use that money. Now, I happen also to agree with Saul that that I don't think that lack of money was the primary problem in New York City public schools, and that makes me more convinced that unless we think very carefully about how to use additional money, we're unlikely to experience any improvements in student outcomes. We're likely to get more of the same, but more of the same with more money. Our challenge, though, I think, given that we're likely to get more money in New York City public schools, is to think about how that money could be used, and I'd like to push an idea today about using that pay to link student performance to teacher compensation, to link improvements in student performance to teacher compensation. The difficulty with spending in the past is that it never really depended much upon performance. More money was provided for buildings, for teachers, and for administrators, regardless of how well students learned. Perversely, schools and staff have been in a stronger position to demand additional spending the worse their students do, proof of which can be found in this lawsuit. A system that financially rewards failure is far more likely to produce failure. What we need is a system that provides financial incentives for success. If we look at how teachers are compensated today, we see a complete absence of financial incentives for teachers to improve student learning. Basically, teachers are paid more for possessing credentials, such as an advanced degree, and for having taught for more years. A system that pays teachers more for obtaining credentials and for more years of experience just produces teachers with more credentials and more experience, but doesn't produce more learning. And it doesn't produce more learning because, unfortunately, credentials and experience are not strongly related to student achievement. Now, we could get very wonkish and walk through lots of detailed studies, but reviews of the scientific literature by Rick Handischek at Stanford, by the Abel Foundation, have all found that there is not a scientifically valid research literature to show a link between the system that we use to compensate teachers and student performance. But you don't even have to believe those people. Yesterday, when I testified on this very question to the New York City Council's commission, co-chaired by Arthur Levine, the president of Teachers College, admitted that it's unfortunate that we do not have evidence to demonstrate the link between these characteristics and student performance. So he agrees with that. I imagine that not everyone will agree, but I think that a fair look at the evidence on this question shows that we do not have a link between these things, between how we pay teachers and how students learn. And so what we need to do is to more directly compensate teachers in a way that's related to what we care about in schools, which is improving student learning. And there have been systems that have tried this. And now, merit pay is a new thing. It hasn't been used very extensively, but there have been attempts at this. And one place where it's been attempted is in Tennessee. And in fact, this was in the same place where there was a class size study. Now, people who tell you what we desperately need is to reduce class size almost always point to a very rigorous study that was done in Tennessee called the STAR study, where students were randomly assigned to larger classes and smaller classes. And random assignment is great because you get students who in their backgrounds are going to be nearly identical, but you can look at whether the difference in the treatment they receive, whether that produces a difference in their outcomes. And Tennessee's STAR study found that, in fact, students in smaller classes had better achievements than students who were in larger classes, and people regularly point to that as proof that we need to lower class size. Well, that same study, that same experiment, also was examined by researchers at Swarthmore, looking at the merit pay system that they also had in Tennessee. Again, because students were randomly assigned to larger and smaller randomly assigned to different schools, you could compare students who were in classrooms with teachers who were covered by a merit pay system to students who were in classrooms that were not covered by a merit pay system. And according to Thomas D. and Benjamin Keyes, they found that, quote, that the benefit of being a student in a classroom with a teacher who was paid with a merit pay bonus, that benefit was, quote, equal to 40% to 60% of the estimated gains associated with assignment to a small class. Furthermore, these gains are approximately equivalent to a third of the corresponding black-white gap in test scores. So the same experiment shows that you get a marked improvement from a merit pay system. Now, of course, you might ask the question, if it's only about half as large as class size, why don't we just do class size since that's bigger? And I think the reason why you might not want to do that is that class size reduction costs a whole lot more. And it costs a whole lot more because to reduce class sizes by about one-third, which is what they did in Tennessee, roughly increases your expenditures by about one-third. You have to have one-third as many classrooms and one-third as many teachers, and so that is quite expensive. Merit pay is not very expensive. You can get this half benefit for a very small fraction of the cost. If you want to get more bang for the buck, merit pay would be a better way to go. Now, if cost is really no object, and in New York City it sometimes feels like it's not an object, then I would say do both. Lower class size and have merit pay. The same study, the same random assignment data supports both. So if we don't care about efficiency, if we don't care about cost, let's do both. I think that it's hard for people to support the idea of class size and at the same time reject a teacher pay system that's supported by the same evidence. Now, I also think there are some good reasons to pursue merit pay instead of classroom if cost is an object, because the merit pay system in Tennessee was a rather weak one, and it's possible to develop one that's much stronger. The merit pay systems sometimes aren't really merit pay. There's a danger that you can call anything merit pay, even if it's not. And so a system, for example, that rewards teachers based on peer assessments where everybody gets the highest grade is really just an across-the-board pay increase. It's not really merit pay. And so the more clearly you align teacher bonuses to improvements in student learning, I think the more powerful the incentives will be, and you might reasonably expect a larger benefit than was seen in the Tennessee program, which was not as clearly linked directly to student performance. So now the concern, though, is if you link teacher pay to student performance, to improvements in student performance, won't you just create perverse incentives to teach the test, cheat on the test, manipulate test results? Won't you in some way deprive education of its full and rich quality? I don't think that that is actually necessarily a big concern. For example, in a study that I led that was just published in Teachers College Record last year, we looked at the results of high-stakes tests and low-stakes tests in 2 states and 7 large school districts around the country. What's useful about looking at both high and low-stakes tests given to the same kids around the same time is you get to see whether stakes distort results. If you make consequences attached to test results, do you create the incentives to somehow manipulate the results so that they would come out differently than a test where there are no stakes attached? We found actually that high and low stakes tests given to the same kids around the same time correlate at a very, very high level. They correlate very well. In other words, stakes are not fundamentally distorting the information the tests produce in these jurisdictions where we studied. And it makes sense that would be possible, both because teaching to the test could be an okay thing if the test contains the information that we want students to learn. Then teaching reading and teaching math might be a good thing. Teaching to the test, or the stakes are not a serious source of distortion if you have a reasonable set of checks in place and auditing in place to prevent perverse reactions to a system that's more clearly linked to testing. In the same way that we have an income tax, which does create a perverse incentive for people to distort reporting of their income. But our system of income tax works pretty well, and it works pretty well because there are some systems of checks in place and some auditing, and for the most part, people are honest, and they respond to the system well. And so it's clearly possible to have a system that links teacher pay to student performance without fundamentally undermining the integrity of the test results and producing perverse reactions. I think, you know, fundamentally the problem with any system that pays teachers based on something that is not related to student performance is that it won't produce better performance. And it's a little bit like paying the Mets players based on hat size. What you'll end up with are bigger-headed baseball players who get a lot of money and don't play baseball very well. And similarly in teaching, when we pay more based on credentials and experience, we just end up with more senior teachers with lots of master's degrees. But we don't end up with better teachers. Now, by suggesting that we need to align teacher pay better with student performance, I don't mean to suggest that teachers are mean people who only will care about kids if you pay them to do so. I think most teachers, like most people, care about kids and want to do their jobs well. But like most people, teachers are likely to do a better job if they're rewarded for doing so. Rewarding excellent teachers helps attract and retain those people as teachers. And denying automatic pay increases for unsuccessful teachers may also have the benefit of encouraging those less capable teachers of leaving the profession. Most skilled professions link pay to performance. It's time that we do the same in education. If New York must spend significantly more money on its schools, using the money to fund a meaningful merit pay system is one of the most promising options I can think of.
Thank you. I do want to take a couple of questions from the audience, but Jay had put sort of a new idea on the table, the idea of linking teacher pay to improve student performance. And Randy, I don't know if you want a second to address that.
Let me, I actually, which I'm sure Jay does not know, I sit on the most interesting value add task force in the United States of America, the one that emanates out of the University of Pennsylvania with Ted Hirschberg. And ultimately, the folks in Tennessee, all of them, the RAND study, have gone and said, warning, warning, don't do this yet. Rand concludes, quote, despite growing enthusiasm, the existing research base on value added suggests that more work is needed before the techniques can be used to support important decisions about teachers and schools. And in Tennessee, with Saunders, the Rand study itself, concluded that these results cannot be used to pay teachers, period. So the issue here is not about pay for performance. The issue is, and, you know, on merit pay plans, I can go through Fairfax, I can go through every single merit pay plan that has been tried, has been unsuccessful. But both Hirschberg and even Denver, in their pay for performance plans, have said over and over and over again, or in any of these new modalities, they've said over and over again, the real key is you need to look at the school, you need to look at the school as a community, and the community needs to work together and collaborate together. So the bottom line is, if we could do maybe something like a hard-to-staff differential looking at all schools, if we could do something like even go back to the breakthrough for learning model, where we saw what different schools might want as their benchmarks, and as a whole school give an incentive if that school got to those benchmarks. That would be an idea that even if my union was initially skeptical of, an idea we could look at. But let's not, when we know that there's an idea that's been tried in lots of different places around the country, and when you look at all these reports that Jay just talked about, and you actually read the conclusions have said, warning, warning, don't do this and connect it to pay.
Okay, thanks. I'd like to take some questions from the audience. You have to speak into the microphone. It seems clear from our panel that over the next 5 years, the school system is going to get something like $23 million. Is it a good idea? How do you spend it? Henry Stern, you have a question? We'll wait until the microphone comes to you, okay?
Question for Ms. Weingarten on educational methods. How do you feel about phonics as compared to whole word teaching to read? And how do you feel about traditional math as compared with new math or fuzzy math? Can you tell us?
I actually, on a personal level, and based upon the research that I see, I actually agree much more with Saul Stern and with Diane Ravitch than with what is being done in the system right now. I think there has to be a balance, but what we have right now is not a balance. We basically have whole language run amok. And I am very worried about what we are doing in terms of helping all children learn. The best, I was never an elementary school teacher. I was a high school teacher, and I was a lawyer. So we are going well beyond what I actually taught here. But every elementary school teacher I know and I see in the school system right now has said, even if they believe in the teacher's college modality of focusing on reading workshops and writing workshops and the workshop model and all the pedagogo that you hear these days, the shackling of teachers and the disabling of them from using their skills to be able to teach to the individual needs of children is mind-blowing at this moment in time. No curriculum is going to be perfect for all children. The real key is you have a curriculum that is aligned with the standards and is one that is based upon common sense and research. And I would argue to you, Henry, that what we used in the Chancellor's District, which was a district that even Tony Cole's former boss, Rudy Giuliani, gave us $1 million more per school, and Rudy Crewe and I turned around 40 schools at that time We had 65 really low-performing schools in the Chancellor's District at one point or another, of which 62 were no longer on the low-performing school list. Some of them closed. Most of them got off because of the combination of inputs that we put together, including well-qualified teachers, more time not just for actual classroom instruction, but for small group instruction for kids who are falling behind, as well as professional development, and a skills-based curriculum that had some of the elements of balanced literacy and some of the elements of everyday math, but one that was focused on basic skills.
Herman?
I think there may be another legal complication, which would not be unusual in a case that has been going on for 10 years. The Court of Appeals has told Judge LaGrasse to set the amount of money that has to be increased in the budget. And if he approves the recommendation of the Masters to provide for $5.3 billion, there's a problem because there's another more recent Court of Appeals decision which has to do with another section of the Constitution that says that the legislature cannot force the governor to increase the budget. And so if the governor refuses to increase the budget, even if the legislature approves the $5.3 billion, then can the governor be forced to increase the budget by $5.3 billion or any amount if he doesn't want to do it?
Saul, you want to take a shot at that?
Well, I think we may be headed towards a constitutional crisis in any event, regardless of that decision that you point out. And part of the background, and there's a little element of unreality in our discussions here, spending all this money. Where's the money? We got, you know, the state is $6 billion in deficit. The city is $2 billion in deficit. You know, Mayor Bloomberg, who was testified at the Masters hearing, you know, effusively about how, despite the fact that 2 years ago he said, give me the job, I'll get it done with $12 billion, is now saying, I can't get it done for 15 and I need another 5.6. But he was saying, give me the money. And then when he sort of woke up one morning and realized that, you know, the city might have to pay a share of this, he sent his attorney into the courtroom a couple of weeks ago and said, no way. If you want us to pay for it, we keep the money. We don't want the money. Now, Randy points out it's not his money, it's the children's, and in a way he's right. But it's interesting, isn't it, that the mayor of the city that's supposed to benefit by all this money has in effect said it's not that important, and if I have to pay for it, I'm not going to pay for it. But the reality is that neither the city nor the state can pay for this. It's just the money is just not there. So, Herman, to answer your question, I think don't start spending the money yet. We're headed for a rather interesting time in the state.
Okay, let me try this side of the room over here, sir.
Nobody's paid any attention here to the state constitution. You go to the appropriations section, it says only money that can come out of the state is through an appropriation bill, all right? Which means that the legislature has to pass an appropriation bill. Now you have a New York City upstate crisis in this thing. If you take, forgetting Republicans and Democrats, if you take all the legislators from New York City and they voted for this, they still can't pass it. And then there's another point that nobody's raised yet in the Constitution, and this is because the case was brought as a city bill. Normally, education is considered a statewide function, which normally you have a majority vote on an appropriation bill. But when money goes specifically to a certain locality, that changes by in Section 20 of Article 3 to a two-thirds vote. Now, I'm not saying that they're going to need a two-thirds vote because this is something that's never been raised before. But since the case is specifically to New York City, that's what it says, where money goes to a specific locality. And in addition, you still need the legislature to pass an appropriation bill.
Randy, you said you wanted to respond to that?
What ultimately will happen is that once the, Herman's right, once the court decision came down from the Court of Appeals this year about budgetary authority, this put much more of this case into the governor's hands, which actually has made it much more of a political issue as well, and not one that, if you think about it, he really wants to deal with. And frankly, I have to give him credit, because he really did try to settle the case, as did the plaintiffs, over the Thanksgiving weekend. And the entity that tried not to settle the case, the entity that actually didn't try to settle the case, was the city of New York. And so I think what happens, and I think actually the New York Sun said this in an editorial, this is going to be both a legal and a political issue. It needs to be settled on a statewide basis, not strictly on a city basis, for all the underlying reasons that Dave was intuing. And ultimately, I also believe, as I think many of my colleagues on the panel do, that if people do not understand what they are buying, they're not going to just send any school system a blank check. And that's why the accountability piece, regardless of where you sit, becomes just as important. The last thing I want to say is this. Sal is right on the issue of where the money goes in the New York City public school system, because even though the city system may get $15 to $18 billion right now, the chancellor said this September that only $4 billion of which actually goes into classrooms or into remediation. So I, too, have the question, where is the rest of the money going?
Good. I think we have time for one more question. Anybody else? Michael, right next to you back there.
We had spoken, and it had been mentioned about retention being a major problem. And the panel is right. One-third of the teachers leave in 3 years, a half leave in 5 years. One of the things that I have seen is, as a regent, I would visit schools out around New York City, outside of New York City. I can only tell you, New York City has become a farm team for educators outside of New York City. You've got the superintendents of New Orleans, Cleveland, San Francisco, Atlanta, Hartford, and I can continue going. These were superintendents or leaders in New York City. You can find outside of it, and when you ask the people, because, you know, these were folks would come over to me, and I'd say, why are you leaving? Why are you here? It's easier. I also make more money. So somewhere you've got to deal with the issue. It's not going to go away, and it's criminal that we educate these folks and they go elsewhere to help other kids.
Do you have a question for the panel?
How do you deal with that?
Okay, good. Great. Jay, why don't you go ahead?
Well, turnover isn't necessarily a problem if you're getting rid of teachers who are less good and keeping teachers who are better. The problem is turnover where you're losing better, turnover is a problem if you're losing your better teachers. Now, how do you keep your better teachers? You identify them and reward them for being better. Part of the frustration that teachers feel and an injustice to teachers is that they look at their peers and they see that someone who is lazy and not as good as they are gets paid the same as they do simply because they've been around the same amount of time, or they have the same formal credentials. And that's an injustice, and teachers feel that injustice. And one of the reactions that people have to a situation of that kind of injustice is they either leave the profession for another profession where they can be rewarded for being excellent, or they leave for another place where their excellence can be appreciated, both financially and otherwise. And so I think that turnover, again, we want to focus on retaining the right teachers and getting rid of the wrong ones. Briefly, I wanted to respond to the warnings that we not yet use merit pay systems, value added systems for merit pay. We have to ask the question: compared to what? Our existing system has no evidentiary support, trying something different, it sounds promising. And in fact, I would make a modest proposal. that might be lower cost and less risky. Why don't we experiment with merit pay? In fact, why don't we have a random assignment experiment in New York City where we shift some schools to merit pay and other schools we don't? We assign them by lottery, and we track outcomes to see if it makes a difference.
Okay. Ryan, you have the last question?
This is kind of a broad philosophical question. It's really for Ms. Weingarten. Assuming the city gets this money and we start paying, as Sal's saying, around $18,000 per pupil, 5 years from now, 6 years from now, we're not seeing an improvement. Who can the people of New York hold accountable when the process has worked the way it has?
Well, you know, I have said one of the things that I said when I made my speech this summer or this in May about the Enterprise Zone is that I believe that if you did something like this where you had an Enterprise Zone where you focused on how you trump socioeconomic conditions instead of how you pit one person against one another, which is essentially what Jay is saying, that within 3 years you will end up having people knocking down those doors of those schools. And one of the reasons that I am actually trying to do a charter school or two is because I'm tired of having the union and the teachers being blamed for everything and having no power to change schooling. When the chancellor dismantled the chancellor's district, which was the single most important and effective turnaround school district in the United States of America, I realized that it was much more about power and control than about really helping kids. And what I would also say to Jay is that we have looked at this issue of teacher quality, and you can't tell me that when you have a 50% turnover rate of our newest folks that you're going to be able to dissect and tell who's good and who isn't good. What ultimately happens right now is that we need to figure out ways of valuing the profession and making it one where every single child has a great teacher, as opposed to trying to pit people against one another, which is what your ideas would presuppose. And the last thing I'll say is this. If those ideas were really very valued by the school teachers, why would I, as the union leader, in survey after survey after survey of my members, private surveys, not public surveys, where they say, we don't want to do what Jay has suggested?
Right. Well, look, Justice DeGrasse has said that he's going to decide on the recommendation to him, which is basically $23 billion over 5 years by the end of January. So it'll be interesting to see what he says. Stay tuned, and I can tell from the panel today we're going to have a lot more to talk about. Thank you all for coming.